He is Justin Davis, user experience designer and late co-host.
And he is Aubrey Goodman, web services genie and commander of all things code and information architecture and all of the things pretty much under the sun. And this is a little show that we like to call Distilled.
Welcome.
Yeah, so here we are.
On this, this is a commemorative episode, at least for me.
Commemorative?
Yeah. Hmm. 1 year ago tonight, I wrecked my car and almost died. So, you know, I'm celebrating not dying.
Which is a fairly good celebration to
It is. I
have.
Celebrate that every day now, since I feel like I really had the opportunity to not do that.
Yeah.
And fortunately for me, it did not go the way that it could have gone, and could easily have gone much, much worse.
Yeah,
so I'm very thankful to be alive, and you know, I hope you guys are too.
Yeah.
But as a result of all that, there's no bourbon for me today, and since there is like one splash of bourbon for Justin, we've decided to just bow out.
Yes. So we this is an abstinitious. Version of Distilled.
Yeah. Which is blasphemy from my perspective, but you
it
know.
It truly is. We should probably call the thing, well, water's distilled. Distilled water.
Distilled water
is what it is today.
Yeah, except I'm not even drinking that.
Yeah, I know, right? No kidding.
So
anyway.
So this week we're talking about insert topic here, Justin.
Yeah, well, there's a lot. I have like about 8 topics we could talk about.
And mine are all redacted.
I've done a lot of things over the past week, getting the Drawer website up and running. The Drawer app, where you can actually see all your stuff that you've created in the app online now, dynamically, which is really, really cool. It's been a really cool experience. I had some really funny noob mistakes that I made yesterday resulted in me not getting email for 2 days.
Please tell us.
Yeah.
All your mistakes. Just document them. Make sure. Oh, is this on? Are we
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I'm going to write a book about just like all my fuck ups, like basically how to do everything wrong and still launch a product. Yeah, I'll actually
we should co-author that book.
Yeah, I'll actually dive right into that one. I was originally going to serve the Drawer web app from S3. Mm-hmm. The way that the app is built. Yeah.
Oh.
This gets funny. The way that the app is built, it's a backbone JS app, right? And so it consumes my API that's sitting on Heroku. And so there's no real back end per se to the web app. It's all remotely restfully controlled. So it's essentially just serving static web pages, right? Mm. HTML, CSS, JavaScript. So I thought, well, okay, it's, you know, S3 is really good at serving static things, so I'll do that. And S3 is really cheap and at serving static things, so we'll do that. So I put it up originally on S3, and everything was working fine. It took a little cajoling to get it to work perfectly, but one thing, by the way, with S3 is that the default bucket privacy settings are that no one can see anything.
Right.
And so every time you upload a new file, everything stops working until you set the permissions on it to, but you can set a bucket policy to where everything is. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was one learning. So I do this, right? And I'm serving it up on S3. And so I'm having a conversation with a friend of mine who runs a website called SceneKids. And we're talking about SEO. And over the past month or two, I really started to really understand the value of having some SEO components to a site.
That is search engine optimization for the uninitiated.
Indeed. And I had always like bad-mouthed SEO because, frankly, a lot of SEO folks are scam artists.
Yeah, they're just trying to charge you monthly for sending you a fucking analytics report that you could generate.
Yeah, exactly, right? Or be like, oh, let me, here, I'll pay you, pay me $5,000 and I'll put meta tags on their pages, right?
That kind or they're acting as a middleman for Google Analytics, which provides an enormous amount of value in that anyway.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly, right?
I've been on that side of it.
Oh, God. It's just horrible. So I'd never really given much credence to it, but after I started putting the web app up, I started realizing, well, man, there's a lot of content here that needs to be indexed so that people can maybe organically start to find it. Obviously, it's not going to drive a whole lot of traffic initially, but I wanted to get it set up to where it would. Now, this raises an interesting question. All this is going to tie together. It's going to be wonderful. Which is, if you have a dynamic app that's served like from, say, Backbone.js using a RESTful API like I am, or really any dynamic JavaScript application, how do you get Google to index it?
Right.
See, the problem is the Google bot can't execute JavaScript. And so when you have a Backbone.js app, you're directing all requests to the index.html page, right? And so basically it just it indexes a single page.
One page with no dynamic content.
Right.
Basically no content at all. It's
exactly.
It's just like a body tag that's empty.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Almost. I mean,
just
not,
about, yeah.
Not that.
And just a whole bunch of script tags that contain HTML,
right.
Strangely enough.
Yeah.
Which is just, anyway, another topic. Anyway, so I started looking into this, and it turns out that you can use this thing called Phantom.js, which is a headless WebKit browser, essentially, to render out the web pages and send them to the Googlebot. Be like, okay, Googlebot, you request this. I'll send you the pre-rendered page back so it indexes that.
Right, which is better than not indexing anything.
Exactly. So there actually is a service out there that does this very thing called prerender.io. It's their whole gig is just doing this. Now, they do it for free. They basically just open source the code. They basically turn the Phantom.js. It's like Phantom.js as a service, essentially, right? Mm. And you can either download their source and spin up your own node instance, or...
I'm just laughing because Phantom.js as a service, like, that works out to, like, PJs as a service, which is probably a different
thing. Which actually sounds amazing.
That would be more like Dollar Shave Club.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Now we're in hard goods. Yeah. No, anyway, I'm not going to...
jokes withheld.
Yeah. And so they have this service at prerenderio.herikuapp.com that you can just basically point the Googlebot there. Mm. And it will essentially take every request from the Googlebot and render out your page and send it back, blah, blah, blah. I won't get into the details.
Hmm.
The important detail to this is that to be able to do this, you need to be able to redirect just the bot to the service.
Hmm.
And to do that, you need to use something like htaccess with a rewrite rule and rewrite condition to redirect the bot's path. This leads us to the problem with S3. S3 is great until you need to do anything
dynamic.
Right. So they have these redirect rules, but the redirect rules are not very good. I was even emailing the guys at pre-render. I was like, can you do this? And the guy was like,
Right. Not so far as I know.
So I decide, after some conversation again with my friend who runs SceneKids, Josh, I said, okay, well, I guess I need to take this off of S3 because this is just indicative of a problem that I'm going to have over and over again, and the non-scalability of, or the non-flexibility of the S3 platform in building a fairly robust web app. So I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. I need to move this. So he convinces me to use DigitalOcean, which is just a hosting provider that gives you a VPS, and basically it's $5 a month for just a box. Box has nothing on it. It's just a box. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a Ubuntu box, right?
Yeah.
So it's a pretty good thing. It's lightning fast. He's using it to serve up about 9 million page views a month on his site.
Not
and
too
it's
shabby.
Performing fairly decently. So, you know, I trust that it's working pretty well. So I move everything over. Now, here's where things get interesting. Pay attention to the bouncing ball here as we follow along the DNS train. So around Thanksgiving, let's call it November 30th, I moved my DNS. I pointed my DNS for my domain at S3. Propagated in a couple hours, and everything was hunky-dory. The domain was resolving correctly.
Routine.
Everything was working great. Then I go back into the DNS and I repoint the DNS, the name servers, to DigitalOcean after moving it to DigitalOcean a few days ago. And it propagates within an hour, I think. Cool. Everything's good. Hmm. I go into Google, into the Webmaster's tool, and I had created this sitemap generator thing, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But I created this thing to generate the sitemap, and I point the Google sitemap tool at domain/sitemap.xml. And Google says, 404. Can't find it.
Because?
So I take the URL, and I paste it into the browser, and it shows up.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, no, Google, wrong.
Bad Google.
No, bad. It is there. So I fight this for like 2 days, and Google just keeps going, no, sitemap.xml does not exist. Yeah. I cannot find that. As it turns out, after some after much investigation and gnashing of teeth, Google had somehow been caching the DNS for like 2 weeks. It had never even changed over to the S3. It was still pointing at my box in Nashville, the original part. And it wasn't like it was caching the pages. Mm-hmm. It was caching the DNS, because I would add comments into the source and then see those show up in the Google Fetches Google Bot thing. This sucks. Well, so I finally get that, strangely, yesterday resolved itself. It just all of a sudden worked.
I'm going to guess that Google is caching and that their cache expired.
Yeah, gotta be. And maybe they're caching like every 2 weeks.
That's
for
the
DNS,
only thing that would make any sense.
Which
that.
Is an incredibly long TTL, by the way.
Yeah. Like 100,000 TTL? Not even.
That's
longer than that.
Yeah, that's really long.
In 2 weeks, it'd be like a million seconds.
Yeah, it's really crazy, honestly. So yesterday, or 2 days ago, something occurs to me. I haven't gotten an email at my drawer email address lately.
Because?
Enter noob moment. So, and I feel safe, and I can admit this. So I'm looking at this, and I'm like, well, why is it my email resolving? This is really strange. And so I asked Matt, and I said, I said, this is a really dumb question, to which he said, there are no dumb questions. I said, no, this is a really dumb question. if I point my name server somewhere else, does it just figure out what to do with the mail?
No.
Answer, no.
Resoundingly, no.
Yes. Those little MX records, as it turns out, those are important.
Mail exchange records.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Right. And so he says... It was funny, too, because Matt's like, it's such a dumb question. Matt doesn't even understand what I'm asking. He's like, what do you mean?
What do you mean?
surely you're not asking if you have to point your mail server. Tell the domain where to go to your mail. Like, and so like, I'm looking at this, and I'm like, okay, gotcha. So MX Records, I couldn't figure it out. I was like, I have no idea. What do I point that at? What do I put in for the MX record? The name server? I have no idea. So anyway, I somehow managed to do something that I'm getting email now online. But anyway, I'd set up Google Apps to basically manage the MX record stuff, I guess, whatever. Anyway.
Somehow.
Mail is now coming through, but I don't really know how.
You're like, I changed something.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it was, and I don't know what I changed. And now I just, like, I closed my eyes and put my fingers in my ears and went, la, 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 la. And then when I was done, it was working.
Right. Exactly.
Smashing keys.
Yeah.
I don't know what I did.
Well, and what was really deceiving about it is that the day before, the DigitalOcean domain had fully propagated. And I had looked online. I had done like a dig lookup, and it was like everything had propagated completely, according to that.
Mm.
And so I had this fleeting, like, back of my head thought, like, I wonder if I have to do something with the mail. Or will that just work? It'll just follow the name server, and it'll know where to go. And so, right. And so I emailed myself at that from that address to that address just to see if it would work. And it showed up after the name server had fully propagated. But I guess the MX record must propagate at a different rate.
Well, you would probably need to email a different domain. Because if you email yourself at that same domain, then it never leaves the domain. It never goes through the SMTP server at all.
Ah, well, there
so
we go.
That is an, so that I had is this an false errant test. It is an assert true, essentially.
Perfect.
So test passed. Well, why did the test pass? Well, because it says assert true. True is always true. So,
yeah. Yeah, so that was that. So, yeah, very messy past few days. But now it's up. It's still not working completely. It turns out there's some weird stuff with HTML5 push state and the way that hashes are rendered in a URL. I didn't want to have a hash in my URLs. I wanted it to just be pretty perfect permalink URL. Which you can do.
Without a hash?
Without a hash.
You're doing like a slug instead of a hash.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you can do that, but you have to use HTML5 push state, and you have to tell Backbone to use HTML5 push state so that the browser knows what to do.
Because otherwise it doesn't.
Right. It's funny thing about that, though. Push state's not supported on some mobile browsers. And it's not supported in IE.
Anything? Like IE?
No push state at all.
Or IE?
I don't think at all. 9, 10, nothing.
Doesn't support it. Wow.
No.
Okay.
Pretty terrible.
That seems like an oversight. Yeah,
it like seems like a massive oversight.
Massive oversight, yeah.
And so now I'm dealing with these very strange linking problems, and I don't know. Things are still very fragile on the old drawer server.
Mm.
But that's okay. It's all in the name of shipping before you're ready.
Yeah, and I say this all the time. It's an old quote from, I think, Marvin Scaff is the one who told me, I'm sure he got it from somewhere, which is, if you're not embarrassed by your product when you ship it, you waited too long.
Yes. It's so true. It's so true, because the thing about it is when you launch it, people will use it in ways you're like,
Oh, I didn't think anyone would ever do that.
Right.
That's actually backwards to some assertions and assumptions I made early.
Exactly.
Oh, wait.
But in a good way. Oops.
Right. Yeah.
Pop. Damn it. I'm trying so hard.
I know.
Sorry about that, letter listeners. Yeah, so it's like they'll use it.
Pardon the pop, please.
Fuck you. Stop with explosives. Silly sibilants.
Stop it. Anyway.
Yeah. So, yes. And often they'll use it in ways that you go, oh, shit, I didn't think you'd use it that way, but that's brilliant. And I am glad that I launched it before I built much more, because otherwise I would have built a whole lot of stuff that nobody wanted.
Either it's stuff that nobody wants, or it's stuff that people want, but they don't realize what it does because you didn't do a good enough job in designing it for them.
Yeah.
So you're designing it for somebody, but inevitably it's not necessarily the user who actually ends up using your app.
Yeah.
And if you... This is hard for me because I'm sort of walking on eggshells a little here. trying not to redact like half the segment. So, you know, if you have a partner who has a very specific vision on what, you know, your app is going to be for the very first version, because your partner is, you know, has come out of the user space,
right?
Who you are serving to, you know, they're going to have lots of expectations about what it needs to do. It needs to do this, that, and this. I know it needs to do these. These are all the things that frustrated me when I was doing this job. And there's tons of value in that. I really want to leverage that as much as possible. But at the same time, you have to balance that.
Really?
I have to balance that against the things that other users expect, that where those people are not the same.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have those troubles. They didn't experience these pain points the same way. They maybe experienced them, but not necessarily the same way.
Yeah.
So getting through to the partner who insists that it must be exactly, and I mean pixel perfect, exactly what they have in their brain.
Yeah.
Which is a silly thing to say because they don't have pixels in their brain, but assuming that they have a vision of what it looks like in their mind, and then, you know, I mean, I've straight up had conversations where they say, I know what it needs to do, just fucking build it like I think it should do.
Right.
And we'll iterate from there. My attitude is never supportive of that. I'm like, you know what, that's great and all, and I appreciate your input on the design. It really matters a lot. You know, you're getting us to that goal line faster.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Beyond that goal line, the product is going to mutate. It's going to change. It's going to adapt to the larger user community and not just you.
Mm-hmm.
So I've based that on a number of projects so far.
Yeah.
And sometimes I eat my hat at the end of it. And I say, you know what? You were right from the beginning. And I'm sorry about it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry I didn't. I'm sorry I asked you to compromise so much. But generally speaking, that's like 5% of the time. The result, or like the remaining part of the time, it's, oh man, yeah. And it's usually them saying to me, oh man, I can't believe I pushed so hard on this feature. Because once we published this app, you know, the analytics show that no one has ever touched
that
button.
Right.
And it's like, well, it's not because the button's not pretty or that it's not in a good place. It's that nobody fucking cares about that feature.
Right.
You were really excited about a visionary feature that you were excited about.
Yeah.
But no one else is.
Yeah. You can't, you know.
It's a crapshoot. You never know which ones are going to be the blow ups and which ones are going to be the dynamite that, you know, 80% of the users use that feature nine times a day.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's it. It is a crapshoot. I'm actually checking my API for a case study for this exact thing. Oops, that's not an endpoint. This is the endpoint. Unauthorized. God damn it.
You don't have a backdoor into your own API?
No. I do, but I don't.
You don't have your OAuth 40 character tokens memorized?
I know.
What the hell?
I lost.
And you call yourself a technologist.
I lost my key.
You lost your keys? What are you, standing outside your house with a brick?
Exactly.
Ain't no brick for an API.
Exactly.
You can't just like throw a digital brick and crawl in through the window.
Yeah, so this is funny. This is actually exactly... I experienced this exact same thing with Drawer, and I'm glad that... So we have a feature in the app where you can send a place to somebody through the app, like a message.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Sends a push notification when you get it.
Oh, that's new.
All this kind of stuff. Yeah, it was in the initial release. Yeah. So if you go to a place, you can be like, send to a friend. You can select anybody in the app, and you can send it to them with a little message, and it shows up in their inbox and blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's weird, because I tried to do that very thing.
Oh.
Not a month ago, and couldn't figure out how.
Oh, well, maybe it's just too hidden. Maybe that's the problem.
Yeah, too many features, and you're not advertising visibility on all of them effectively.
Yeah, that's exactly it. But what's funny is I spent a long time building that. This whole threaded system with, like, the push notification alone took me several days to get working completely perfectly, And what I didn't build in is you can't, once you get a message, you can't remove it. Like, it's just in there. It's just a long list of, you can't delete it. No, you can't delete it. You can't, like, sort them. You get nothing like that. It's just a dump of messages.
Time ordered.
But the thing is I've only had, since we launched the app about a month ago, I've had three people send a message.
Hmm.
Three. And we have 170, 180 users now using the app.
Yeah.
And three people have sent a message once. Once each. And so it's like, I'm glad I didn't spend much more time customizing the inbox functionality because no one's using it yet.
Or spending all this time theming and styling what that is and allowing all this extra support for customization of the message when only three people have ever done it.
Yeah.
Now, granted, that's still about 1%. So if you have a million users, then suddenly you have 1,000 people or 10,000 people who are saying, hey, this is ugly as fuck.
Right. Yeah, well, that's true.
Usually, that's often a thing that I say as well, which is, I can't tell you whether this is MVP or, you know, whether this is something that needs to go into this app or not.
Yeah.
And since you can't defend it, since you can't give me a really solid reason why it needs to go that isn't because I said so, you know, it needs to be something that goes on the back burner. Why don't we wait until at least 10 users ask for it?
Yeah.
And just set some minimum threshold that says, until that point, whatever that point is, it could be a million users, it could be one.
Yeah.
But until that point, maybe just back off of that feature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so easy to get caught up in all the passion of all these awesome features you absolutely have to launch. It will not survive if we don't. And sometimes that's true.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases, you know, you really do have to get like one or two things really, really well in order to have a successful app once you launch it. And yeah, you could say, well, we launched it and then nobody used it and then blah, 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 and then we added it later or whatever. You know, that's normally how it goes.
Yes. It's, and
you just sort of iterate through it and you add things where appropriate and you feel like it needs to go in there. You have people asking for it, or even you feel like it wasn't something went into a 1.0 product or even a 2.0 or whatever version you're on. It's not good enough for now, but it might be good enough for next iteration.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly. You know, I say all the time, talk to clients a lot and myself.
You know, there are people who will help you with that. They're called bartenders.
Oh, yeah, perfect. You don't have to talk to yourself. You can talk to somebody else who's serving you.
Sometimes they'll send you a free drink if you really sound desperate.
Yeah, no kidding. But you know, I have talked a lot about helping people understand what exactly you should launch with. I mean, what features should be in? What features should be out in V1 or V1.2 or V1.5 or whatever? And especially in V1. The thing that I say to people is that when you launch a product into the world, you have an assumption. You assume that there's a problem in the marketplace, that the thing that you're building is going to help some people, hopefully, solve that problem. And it's usually a very simple assumption. I think people want to keep track of places better.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I assume that there's that problem in the world, that people have that problem, resonate with that problem. And so I want to launch a product that tests that assumption.
Right.
To see if I'm right that it is a problem, right? And the thing is that when you choose what those features are, you have to only launch with the features that test the assumption. And if there are features that are nice but don't aid in testing the assumption, in that, the litmus test for this is, if you take that out, is the core test still valid?
Right.
Right? Then you can safely take it out. To a point. I mean, there's a point where you take too much out to where people don't use the product and the assumption never gets tested. And that's always the line that you're flirting with, trying to figure out what that line is.
Yeah.
But it can be very... And it can be very tempting to misassociate tests that way and be like, well, no, people have to be able to follow other people on this app or else no one like or right. else we don't know if they really want to save places and share them with people. You know, it's like, well, is that true?
It's like
if
they can't do that thing, will they not do the other things
right.
that you need them to do in order to provide the proof?
Right. That your assumption is valid.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to be honest, that game is... there's no way to figure that out except for just sort of taking a best guess. My stance on it is always to launch a lot leaner than you think you should. Only because it's a lot easier to write new code than it is to take stuff out and build around cruft. Mm. That you've already put into the product, right?
Generally, yes. It depends on how well written your original code is.
True.
You know, if you have...
In the case of me, let me tell you, every bit of my code is technical debt immediately.
I don't know what you're talking about. I have never seen any of your code. Wink, wink. I know nothing.
Yeah, you know. Right.
Well, hopefully... Well, no, yeah. Don't say that.
Redacted.
Yeah.
Are you getting good at self-redaction?
Getting better at it.
Yeah.
I think I'm better at it when I don't drink.
Quite clearly.
Yeah. Although editing, sometimes, there was that one episode with Mitch that was so hard to edit because we were all really loud and talking over each other saying things we should not publish.
Yeah. So the episode's like, haha, and...
Yeah.
Just unintelligible fragments of sentences, basically.
In large part, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it wasn't that bad, I don't think.
Yeah.
It was pretty bad, but it was hard. No. Yeah, I think there's a lot of stress in early product development, and especially because it is by definition an insecure position.
Yes.
Your ego is on the line. You have made an assumption and you have built a product, spent someone's money, possibly yours, possibly not yours,
yep,
to build something. And until you can get someone to tell you whether the thing you built is moving in the direction of where they think it should go, and you get 1,000 people to do that, and right, they all say it should go in the generally similar direction, then that will help you to guide, you know, steer the boat.
Yeah.
But if you wait and wait and wait and make all those assertions yourself and you test it internally, yeah, it'll be beautiful and do exactly what you think it needs to do. But if your user expects it to do things that you don't expect it, that it, you know, those are pain points for them, then you're, like you said, it's technical debt from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then not even that, but like potentially you're spending a week or 2 weeks or whatever building something no one fucking cares about,
yeah,
instead of building the one feature that is missing that they really, really need.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what's even more dangerous than technical debt. I'm going to put this on my editorial calendar to write about. This is actually a brilliant blog post, by the way. Mm-hmm. What's worse than technical debt is design debt. And
what?
No,
never.
No one ever talks about this, but the problem with design debt is design debt carries with it technical debt. If you get the design of something wrong,
oh, yeah,
you get the code and the design wrong.
Right. Those, right? 10, what'd you say? The 10 minutes of sketching saves you 10 hours of development?
Yeah. But that shit's real, by the way.
If you spend a day sketching, that's like a year of coding. Yeah, you fucked up.
Exactly.
But you still did after the fact. Like,
exactly.
Once you get to the point when you realize your design is flawed, it's after you've already spent those 10 hours, yeah, for every 10 minutes you sketched.
Mm.
So,
and I don't know that I've ever heard anyone talk about design debt, but they're about to hear about it after the beginning of the year. It's getting on my calendar. By the way, I'm going to get really good at blogging. And by good, I mean like regular. I'm literally creating this editorial calendar that tells me every week what topic I'm writing about, what day it gets published, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. Because it's really important to do that. And I think you have to do that to get regular at it. You know? It's the Metamucil of blogging is an editorial calendar.
jokes again, redacted.
Yeah. look, another new drawer user.
Oh, man.
See, so, look at this. And the blog app that, or the blog app. God, I don't know what I'm talking about. The blogging that I did today has resulted in a rush of new users.
Oh,
so I published a blog. I'm going to do a bi-weekly featured user blog on Drawer, featuring people who are power users of Drawer, linking to all their... Since now it's on the web, so I can do that.
Right.
So I featured Ruben Pressman as the first one, because he has, like, tons of places saved, right? And so I tweeted out this blog post about him, and, like, had, like, this rush of new users today.
Did he retweet it and all that? Of course.
Which was part of the strategy.
Of course, yeah.
Like, people who are loud.
Yeah, exactly. And Ruben is a very vocal guy. He's very active,
very passionate.
Very passionate.
Which
very
is awesome.
In the community.
Yep.
Loves the startup community. Very supportive of... certainly all the Tampa Bay companies.
Yep.
Has several ventures of his own, and he's a young guy too, so he's a very good first candidate for that. I really like this idea of regular blogging, and I mean, in your case, it's good for that SEO factor as well. You link all the places that they link popularly. They retweet it, it goes out to their social network, people who they retweet to also retweet because they're like, oh, I love things that Ruben talks about, whatever. And then you get 50,000 people looking at your page, and then suddenly they click on links, they go to those places. You know, it's just
all
really
good.
It's all really good for you. Now, I want to talk just a little bit about blogging and the kinds of things that we're doing with UpValet.
Yeah.
For that, and I think this actually the strategy is going to really, really work out really well for us, because we're so early in the market and the product. I mean, there really is very, very little. There's one competitor we have, IntelliCar.
Which actually is really surprising.
It is.
That there's not more competitors.
There's so much opportunity for...
It's shocking.
Exactly. I'm like, why?
It almost makes you think you're missing something.
Exactly. Like somebody must be building this product,
Yeah.
Or, well, I don't know. But because we're so early in the life cycle of everything, and you know, we're sensitive to the idea that, now I'm going to put this out there, I would bet $1 million that no one can get this to market before we can, if I had that $1 million.
Nice. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's an easy bet to make, but I think the energy still stands. We are doing a lot of work really, really fast.
Yeah.
Because we have to, and we're getting some great bankroll from some, you know, great strategic partners for us. I'm not at liberty to say who they are, but it enables us to build quickly, to build efficiently, to build the things that they think they need. We have this close relationship with them. Mm-hmm. So they're telling us, I mean, we're doing our first usability test on Monday with our first beta. So we're like right early in that process of starting to collect that user data. So I'm about a month behind you in that context.
Yep.
In getting it to market and, you know, trying to fail as quickly as possible so that we can succeed after failing.
Mm-hmm.
Fail first, fail quickly, fail to the point where you can't, you're testing those assertions, making sure that you're actually close, and maybe you get it right, maybe not, probably not. But that whole fail early thing is great, and especially with, you know, working with these betas, they're allowing us, they're giving us the bandwidth, the flexibility, the availability to have the staff that we need before we are. We were revenue positive now, but we're not profitable.
Right.
So until we get to the profitability point, we can, you know, we're really kind of running lean and all making personal sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly me, I'm like up till 2 and 3 in the morning every day working.
Yep.
You know, from 9 a.m. until like 2 a.m. I'm working every day. Maybe I take an hour off to eat.
Ah, startup life. Yeah. Hashtag.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's a personal sacrifice.
It is. It's a sacrifice of passion, though, right? Yeah.
Well, nah, I don't want. We've anyway. Talked a lot about what all those sacrifices are. Yeah. Sanity.
Personal I mean, it's a sacrifice that is born out of passion.
You would. Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And so what we're doing with our social media and PR strategy is we're blogging. Now.
Yep.
But we're publishing the blogs on a 6-month delay. So we get to talk about it, get the energy out there, get a record of what we're doing, keep track of all these things, you know, all the daily things that come along. I'm trying to keep a record of that. Just like the emotional energy, the pulse of the company as it goes forward. Do that in a private way, but eventually public way.
Yeah.
So we're just doing a nice delay that way. The things we talk about don't end up shooting us in the foot because somebody else who has more resources than we do comes along and hears our shit and says, oh, I can do that faster. That's a great idea. Mm. You know, we still, though, want to get that energy out and talk about it. So we're doing it on a delay so that we don't have to worry about the competition thing as much. Now, that's, I mean, competition is going to jump on your product. Your designs are transparent. Anyone who sees and uses your product who has
can go recreate it today.
Who has the ability and technical know-how to recreate that, understand what they're seeing, see how it, you know, decompose it into, you know, something else and reproduce a similar product. That's impossible to stop.
Yeah.
Even with patents, I don't really think that you can do that, because inevitably if you get a patent, all that really somebody does is try to find your patent's weaknesses and patent around those weaknesses, and then they own your superseded patent, and it's annoying. So, but generally speaking, I tend to suggest to people, encourage people not to try patenting. Just spend all that money on hiring another developer and get to market.
Get a product to market and get market share.
Yeah.
Market share is the biggest defense.
Absolutely. Because that's essentially the main value of trademark is the market share that you build with the copyright that you are leveraging to build that product into that market and sell it.
Right.
So without the market, you have, like, the trademark is useless.
Right.
So really, yeah, it's the trademark and the copyright, I think, that carry the most weight in the early stages. Now, when you're later, you know, you discover some really cool process that really bolsters that initial portfolio, that may be a good thing to patent, but it's generally your
last. A lot of people lean way too much on it, though, right?
Well, yeah, and especially, I mean, usually it's because those companies don't have revenue, they don't have any sales yet, and so they're desperate, they're there's, like, up their VC's ass every day talking about, oh, if you only put in this, then you would value us at this, and then you'd make so much money. Oh, my
right.
God. And it's like, no. VCs want to see patents. If you don't have revenue, they want patents.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And, you know, even if you have a patent, sometimes it just doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I know people who have patents who thought that it was as simple as get a patent.
Right.
And just walk in somewhere and license it.
Right.
No. It's not that easy.
It doesn't work that
way. Not that easy at all. Right. Right. If it was that easy, we'd all just be patenting things.
Yeah. There would be right? 80 million patents instead of 8.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
800 yeah, so. Million. Jesus.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's it. That's it.
I really like that strategy that you're using to bolster the SEO with this kind of featured users. And especially if you're featuring the active users. That's genius, because what it means is that those active users will A, feel inspired and like recognized.
Right.
So they get notoriety from you, which makes them feel good. In a B-side I published for Distilled on Monday of this week, Sophia Liu and I talked about crowdsourcing and ownership in experience and how to drive that adoption and get people to actually engage with your product. A big part of that is making sure that they develop a emotional relationship with the
right.
experience, not with the product, with the experience of using the product.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
The product they will like because the experience of it.
Yep.
They derive joy or, you know, whatever it is.
Ego or
stroke or yep. anything. So all of the things you can do to help them feel good about the experience are good for you, because they will then be more inspired, more likely to go out and socialize about your product.
Yeah.
So if you write a blog post about somebody, they're going to feel really flattered and they're going to go and fucking spam the hell out of their social networks. Mm-hmm. Look what this awesome project wrote about me.
Yeah.
Here I am. I'm a user. Yay.
Exactly.
About drawer. The drawer is awesome. Yay. So by tapping on those emotional piano keys, you can play a great song.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And the other thing is, what it does is it helps other users see for themselves how they could use the product, right? With a product like Drawer, there are actually lots of different ways that you could use it. It's becoming more and more of like a platform type of play. And
infrastructure play?
Yeah, great.
What?
and so what's great about this is that people can read this post about how Ruben's using it, see how he's using it, and be inspired to be like, oh, that's cool. I hadn't thought that I could use Drawer that way. But now that I see how this person's using it, I see myself in the product more now, which is far better than me saying to them, hi, this is my product, use it like this.
Right.
I'd rather them learn.
Here's a t-shirt.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I'd rather them be inspired by the other users to come up with creative ways to use it that they feel represents them best, which is just another corollary benefit of that. So.
Now, I got to say that all this works in your favor very well, because you are running a consumer-facing app.
Right.
None of this is true for B2C.
True.
I mean, B2B.
True. Yes. I mean,
I wouldn't say none. Some of it still applies, but
for B2B, it's more of a case study type of situation, right? I mean, but it's not as effective.
Well, I think,
in this way.
I think if you have a champion user who is the dealership, the car dealership.
Yeah.
Who, I could say, look, we're going to highlight this dealership today. This is how they're using UpValet in their day-to-day. And it's the same thing. That shows the other dealerships how they might use our product in ways they either didn't expect or don't think about. But like basically that testimonial of seeing someone else using it, that case study, weighs so much in that perceptual model in the pre-sale when you're talking to them about what your product does and all that. It's great. You can talk about features and show them demos and show them an app, get them excited about it. But the thing that's going to drive other users to do it is A, fear of missing out. If you're a dealer who doesn't have this tech and you see on a, in some blog post or whatever, somebody sends you like, hey, motherfucker, I saw this guy across that dealership across the street from you just got highlighted on this whatever. You got to check this out. You're missing the boat.
Yeah.
And that will inspire them to get in there and do it. We're working on integrating Bitcoin into car sales for transaction processing for down payments, premium payments or just like cash payment. You're going to buy the car outright. You can pay with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
40 Bitcoin buys you a car.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. And as we've been working this up to our, you know, initial partners, we have been selling this for about, you know, 2-3 weeks now, selling them on the idea, like, oh, you know, you want to be the first car dealership in America to take Bitcoin. I mean, just like dangle that carrot right in front of them. And they're like, oh, my God, I don't know. It doesn't sound that great. And all we're doing is hyping. Because who gives a fuck? No one's going to buy a car with Bitcoin.
No.
I mean, someone already did. But that's where I'm going.
It's not.
It's like somebody did
not entertainment,
a transaction
not.
In right. California.
Yeah. At a Lamborghini dealership.
At a Lamborghini dealership. And that got national press.
Yeah.
So that validated our argument to them saying,
which was huge.
You are already missing the boat.
Right.
Now you want to be the first on the East Coast?
Yeah. Which is such a which is such a great strategy. The fear of missing out thing is so great. And it's like, oh, people are already, you're going to be left behind.
Yep.
And especially in that industry where it's, everyone there is type A sales competitive type of people, right?
Yeah.
And so them to tell them, oh, by the way, you're probably going to be last.
They do not want to hear that.
No, not at all. They will take that challenge every day and run with it. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so great. It's so great. It's a really cool strategy. And the Bitcoin thing. Yeah, it's just really good. I think it's great.
I wish I could talk more about it, you know, because we do have some really great strategic relationships running. And
yeah,
I guess you'll just have to read our blog in 6 months after we sell the company.
That's right.
One of our partners did tell us on Monday this week that he believes that we have a very strong chance of selling our company for $30 million or more in January, 1 month from now.
Wow.
We haven't launched a product yet. We're doing our first usability study.
Perfect.
In 4 days.
Perfect. I love it.
You know, but everybody's lining up to put money in, and we're saying no.
Yeah.
Because we're like, look, we don't need your money anymore. We have
it.
A bankroll from some strategic partners. We don't we don't want to grow too fast because we don't want to fuck it up.
No, yeah. And you will fuck it up if you grow too fast, right? And you try to do too much too quick is really, really bad.
I'm really proud of what we've done in such a short time. I'm also terrified of all of the things we have promised that haven't made their way into the app yet. And, you know, we have daily, sometimes angry conversations about whether or not we need to do that feature by Wednesday, by next week, by January, by April. You know, what are we going to do with all these things? Our initial plan is to launch by April, like full-on launch. But by that point, we will have a $10 million valuation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's crazy town.
Yeah, it is crazy town. It is crazy town. For sure.
it's blowing my mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's again, it's that classic thing. Startup Weekend does this very effectively. They say you have to have the minimum three things to make a company succeed from nothing. A hipster, a hacker, and a hustler. Hustler sells the product, hacker builds it, hipster designs it.
It's awesome.
And if you have those three things and each person, you know, does that role really effectively,
then you will
fly to market.
No doubt.
And that's what's happening with UpValley.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, no doubt.
We sold a PowerPoint a month ago
right.
to three dealerships.
Yeah.
And now we have a product that we're going to be demoing in their hands in 2 days.
Yeah, so cool.
And it's an awesome product. It's not as awesome as we want it to be.
But that's okay.
But it doesn't have to be right now.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
And that's the key.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be awesome and perfect. Perfect is the enemy of good enough. This is written on my door.
It just has to be enough.
Yeah.
It just has to be enough.
It just does.
That's right. But defining what enough is a little bit more difficult sometimes than it seems.
Yeah. We'll leave that for another episode. Well, that's the fourth half of next week's episode.
Channeling car talk there, I see.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. Was there anything else you had?
So I learned to love testing this week.
Oh, that's good. Finally, you learn to love talking about Twitter talking about testing on Twitter, where you say like, "Hey, by the way, it turns out testing is awesome because it shows me all the horrible ways my shit is fucked."
Although, oh man, it was horrible. Like, so I started testing.
How did it even do this? How was it even allowing anybody to create records?
Because
it just weren't working.
Doesn't make sense. That would.
Nope.
Test just failed.
Test fails. Either the test is broken or the app is broken.
And see, that's the damning thing about testing. Uh-huh. Is it's like, am I writing the tests right?
Do I have to like put on a uniform and stand on one leg and recite the alphabet backwards?
Yeah. It's very difficult. Yeah, it's very difficult to know. I don't know. I'm still struggling with like what exactly to test. Great example. Hmm. So I was, so I started writing these tests using the Mocha framework. Mm-hmm. It's very cool. I've written like 32 tests, which is not a ton.
Oh, that's so cute.
It's not very many.
The Verify P app three years ago at its peak had 1,200 assertions.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's where I'm headed. But I'm wondering if I'm testing too big of chunks of functionality. But the problem is,
probably
is that I'm not testing. I'm testing the API endpoints. I'm not testing the API service. So what I mean
by
that,
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Okay, so what I mean by that is like when I run a test, I'm posting to an endpoint and expecting a certain response, and I'm testing against that response,
correct,
just like I'm a client consuming the API,
yeah,
right? But what that doesn't allow me to test are smaller units of functionality on the API side.
Example.
Here's an example. I have a test. Actually, I don't. But let's say I did for creating a new user. App should create a new user. If you post to /user with this information,
yep,
it should return 200 with a record of the user and all of these.
Actually.
201?
201. Oh, created.
Fuck.
Ran into that problem with Rails testing last year when Rails 4 introduced more strictly adhering
to status codes.
201 is created. That's what it's
interesting.
For.
Interesting. Huh. All right. Well, I guess I'll change that.
You could assert that it's 200 series.
Right.
Which would be at least a good test,
yes,
and not a 422, because that's what you're saying. You don't want it to be 500. You don't want it to be 422.
No.
You don't want it to be 401. That would be weird, too.
Yeah.
401 would be like...
Unauthorized.
Unauthorized client.
Right. Right.
Not invalid post.
Which could be true, because I require an API key. I require a private key to... No, it's not OAuth, but it's just a basic auth key that I'm using to... Right. Just so a bot can't create tons of users automatically.
You know,
by posting that endpoint.
I went through this one thing back and forth for a while.
Yeah.
In the derivation of the UpValet API, and at the end of my work with the VerifyP API last month, which was essentially, do you use? Because I guess I have to give it a little more backstory. The VerifyP 3.0 app, which has not hit production yet. Probably early next year, if Nick has anything to say about it. It's a backbone app. So there's a bunch of APIs and then a front-end index.html, basically,
yep,
that serves up that backbone and does all the routing from there.
Yep.
So that uses basic auth. So you log in, and now the JavaScript client has, uses a basic auth token.
Mm-hmm.
Just a hash in the user, and then any character in the password, and that's great. But then when we add OAuth to that, which we had done for single sign-on, we were using the OAuth provider endpoint to register a client, so that you generate the key in secret and all that.
Yep.
And so I had started to integrate that in with also concurrently like supporting both sides of it. So you would have the one token or the two tokens.
Mm.
And after kind of going back and forth over that for a week or two, I finally discovered that it's just not worth it to serve the basic auth.
Yeah.
Because you're going to do it through, through an SSL tunnel. You don't have to worry about whether their, query string params are visible or not.
Yep.
You can even put the query string params, like the client ID and the client secret for OAuth2 into the basic auth header, and Devise will successfully validate that.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
So, I mean, there are like strategies you can use to enable that, essentially, is what I'm saying. It doesn't do that out of the box, I don't think.
Yeah.
It expects username and password.
Sure.
Which is not, we don't have those.
Right.
Because
right,
it's an API client. But the point is that you can register then, you just set that up all, you know, on your API side, and then you register your mobile app as a OAuth client.
So right.
Then your mobile, you can, because the value of this, of course, is that then you can use that, like the tracking indicators on when, you know, how many requests you get using this this identity versus that one. You know, you can see, okay, well, 90% of the traffic coming through my API is my app.
Yeah.
But the other 10% is the, you know, these two, you know, clients that are using it, or 50 or, you know, whatever it is, whatever the volumes work out to be. You can support the OAuth endpoints and, you know, yours at the same time.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not you need an authentication layer to enable security and controlled access to the place where you register for API tokens is another thing entirely.
Right, yeah.
That's a
true
user thing that they log in on the web. They're not doing that from a mobile app.
No.
The mobile client should never be able to just sign up for an OAuth client through an API of its own.
Yeah.
That's a terrible idea, because then a robot will just register for an API token and spam the shit out of your thing all through a completely legitimate portal.
That's right.
And that's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
I frankly don't know what stops bots from doing that. It's like all you have to do is, you know, on with your fingers on your keyboard, type in the shit into the whatever and sign up for that, and then use that as your spam bot.
Right, and just like crank it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I guess you could just argue that there's like rate limiting, and you could just stop. You could say like, no, I'm revoking your shit. Fuck
That's
you.
That's true.
And then,
but they could get a lot through.
But then they could just
the
go and do again,
down.
And it's like, I'm just going to delete your whole username account now.
Yeah.
Fuck off.
Yeah. Yeah. And ban your IP, by the way.
Ban your IP too. Yeah. That's a good idea.
Yeah. So I have this create user thing, and it's just a, you know, post to the user's endpoint, and let's say I have this test that tests to see if the response comes back and all the fields are of certain types to make sure that everything's saved correctly, blah blah blah. And that's how I'm doing this. It's like it gets a response and it tests. It's like username should be a string. This should be an object. This should be a, just so I know that it's saving the right type.
So you're checking type also.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Because I have lots of code that depends on type.
Although everything comes back as a string in a JSON API. A string or a number.
That's true. Yes.
So.
String or number. Right. Or array.
Yeah.
Array.
But array of primitives.
Right.
It's always primitives.
Yeah. Array is where I've been screwed before, because I'll change something to return an object instead of an array, and I have something that's looking to like test the length on the array, and it's like, object does not have method length. Anyway, this is what got me into the whole testing thing in the first place. But the fact of the matter is I had a problem today. Sarah Perez signed up for Drawer this morning, and I was like, oh, cool, Sarah signed up for Drawer. That's pretty cool. So I was going to go look at her profile online to see if she's adding stuff, see if she's, you know, using the app and all that, right? And her username is Sarah in Tampa, which is the same as it is on Twitter.
Yep.
And so I go to getdrawer.com/Sarah in Tampa, and it just craps out. The app just crashes. And I was like, didn't crash,
like,
but it just like
error?
Crashed out. And I was like, what? And so I like keep doing it, and I keep searching.
Do you mean a backbone crash or a
backbone crash?
Okay,
right. Like, so the app just like didn't display.
White,
just
white
like,
screen, but
white
no
screen, nothing. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so that's the worst.
Yeah,
there's no error
like,
anyway.
Wait, so what?
Nothing in the console.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Fuck you, JavaScript.
Yeah,
fuck you.
It really sucks. So I was like, what the hell's going on? So I'm searching for her on the site search, and she's showing up under that username, and I'm like, this makes no sense. Like, how is? And I'm looking at other people's pages, and all of their pages are working, but hers isn't. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. You can't have one user whose page doesn't show up, and everyone else's does. That's not logical. That cannot happen. Well, it turns out. Noob mistake. I was not trimming white space on usernames.
Oh.
And so it was Sarah in Tampa space.
Oh no.
Right? And so I had figured this out because I went to the database and I looked at the record and I was like, oh, I like something told me that this might be the issue. So anyway, the fact is that so I went in and I changed the user's create endpoint to basically username.trim, so it trims it off. Fine. Easy fix. But the fact is, the way that I'm building the tests, There's no way for me to test that trim functionality to make sure the trim is working and is returning a trimmed version of the username. Unless I set up the dummy data that's being posted to have a space, and then when it comes back, run a regex on it to make sure that the space is now gone, which I can do.
That is exactly
what probably the way to do it. But now that assertion is now bundled into a larger, huge, just create user test. Well, which, if that one line fails, it'll be difficult to find in the test.
That's what you need to have finer granularity on your test.
Right.
So you need, like, do the post and then have, like, an assertion that says, assert that I did not get, like, I assert 201, then assert, like, line at a time, assert that this matches that, type equals that, cool, assert that and that and that. That way your individual assertions might fail, but the whole test doesn't just bail if one of them fails.
Right.
Because that's the problem, I think, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
If you have a space and then there's like everything else is fine, it's 200 or 201, everything's good to go, and then it comes back and it's like somehow, like you get to that one, it's like, nope, failed. But then the way that would look to your test suite is test failed.
Exactly. That's how it looks.
That's not enough.
So what I would have to do then is essentially I would have to invoke that post for each different field separately.
That,
like, post create a user, check this is right.
Yeah.
Okay, post create a user again, check that this field is right. Post create a user again, check that that field is right.
And
so it's like a test. It's like a post for every single field that's on the object.
It wouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter if you are doing testing in a perfectly isolated environment. And what I mean by perfectly isolated is there is no data at all in the database other than the very minimum that you need to, you know, handle background, whatever, anything that's going on with a, you know, it's like asynchronous behavior. After you save this, then this other shit happens, or this data has to be there because there's a lookup for this before we save this or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, if you, every single time you post, you wipe the database and then like the next test, set up the database, run the whatever, do in isolation. And then, that way the tests run a lot slower, but they test more thoroughly and more effectively. Without, you don't get cross pollination of one test affecting the others, and then sometimes the test fails, sometimes it passes, and that's terrible. You don't want that at all,
because
then you're like, it's an ambiguity that you then have to resolve. It's a cognitive load for you as a developer, and you know, trying to, you're essentially now fighting with yourself.
Yeah.
Instead of fighting with the broken code
that
you wrote last time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I haven't figured out yet how to set the tests up to where it scaffolds the database with data. For some reason, I cannot get my head around how to do that.
Yeah, you'll work it out.
I want to just be like Mongo import JSON hash. But
I don't know how to do it in Node. I know how to do it in Rails, but you know, you use a fixture or a factory or something like that.
Right.
You know, to load that data in.
I'm sure there's a way, but
YAML file.
YAML file.
What you need.
Perfect.
A JSON file.
That's exactly what
I need. Bunch of JSON fixtures is probably what you want.
That's it. I mean, just want a whole bunch of JSON that I just go, here, stuff that into the database.
Right. Read this. Like, the database starts at here, baseline. And then you just say, dump all this stuff into the database and then run the test. Then wipe the database. Then stuff all this stuff in again. Run the next test.
Exactly.
So
that's exactly what I want to do.
That's what I would recommend.
Yeah. Alrighty,
well, I hope you folks learned something here. We like to try and teach you things.
Covered a lot of ground today.
Certainly talk about the frustrations that we go through on a daily basis, so you don't have to.
Yeah, buddy.
And that's how we do it here on Distilled.
Yep, that's it. And we'll do it again next week.
Yeah, and probably not the week after because of the Christmas, but
Right.
Who knows?
Golly, that's hard to believe.
I know, it is.
Anyway, all right, folks.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.